Hello, folks. What's the crack? Welcome back to the Mental Health Show and a very, very special episode nonetheless. Because, hey, don't bust my chops. I'm trying out our new brand name here, dude.
You just said, what's the crack? And I'm afraid for any of our listeners outside of the lovely Hamlet of Northern Ireland.
Hamlet's generous.
Could you translate what's the crack for our dear listeners who may be from other parts of the world?
Okay, so I'm going to give you just the rundown real quick because this is a PhD like level topic on the Irish language, but crack basically just means, you know, what's the best way to say this? Let's paint a picture with words. That's what we do, isn't it?
It's not like crack cocaine. Let's just stick.
Okay, yeah. Thank you for clarifying that and getting that out of the way. It's not like crack cocaine. It's spelled C-R-A-I-C. And crack is basically that beautiful, warm feeling you have whenever you're out with all of your mates in the pub, or, you know, it's Christmas time and all your family's over and you're telling like so many jokes and your stomach hurts because you're laughing too much and you've just got that beautiful sense of togetherness. That is crack.
So it is like crack cocaine.
It is like crack cocaine, that warm fuzzy feeling you get, that warm blanket. But, you know, it's a common kind of like greeting we have over here where it's like, you know, what's the crack? Like, what's going on? Or you would say any crack. Like, is there any good feeling happening in your life currently?
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah, thank you for that. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, I am Steve Ilardi, and this is my intrepid co-host, Hugh James. If you haven't figured that out yet, we didn't actually make form. I was just busting your chops right out of the gate. Because
what we do in the show.
That's what we do. Speaking of which, I need to announce that Hugh and I both, this is our inaugural video portion of a podcast that we launched, I don't know, God, it's been 3.5 months ago or so. It was called The Mental Health Show. And, you know, I did it too.
My very first words were The Mental Health Show.
Okay, there, yeah. So I guess it's official now. It is called The Mental Health Show. It used to be called The Mental Health Podcast, but now, you know, we've expanded. Why? We're here on YouTube. So we've got video. And we decided for our very first inaugural video portion that we'd both get shiny new haircuts.
Look at that.
And Hugh, of course, being the diligent, conscientious fellow that he is, and having this glorious head of 27-year-old hair, it was leonine, you know, which is to say like a lion's mane. Now it's just very sheen.
I've never heard the word leonine, you know.
Oh.
Leonine. I'm going to write that one down. This is the word Steve taught me today.
Leonine is indispensable. Indispensable word.
I'll keep it in my back pocket. You use crack and I'll start using leonine.
There you go. I'll take that trade any day of the week. And I did have an appointment to get my haircut on Saturday. And my haircutter person, stylist, I guess, barber, she texted me. As God is my witness, I'm getting in my car. And she said, we've lost all power. If you want, I can try to cut your hair by candlelight or with the flashlight on my... And I was like, no, I'm good.
You're like, I'm married.
That too. So anyway, here I am. You can't see, thank God. I've got the headphones on, but it's out of control.
Is this how you feel whenever a student comes into your class and gives you like a really bogus excuse for not doing their homework?
Like the dog ate it or yeah.
Oh, my stylist's par went out.
I literally can show you the text through
the calendar or it didn't happen, bro.
Okay.
We have video format now. We can like lean into that. No. For the sake of our audio listeners, I'm going to trust you. But off mic, off camera, I'm going to bust your chops.
Off camera. Yeah. And then you can testify next week that I...
So this is a Q&A episode. This is something we've been trying out over the last couple of weeks. We've been really enjoying it. And so we're going to kick off with a wonderful question submitted by one of you. So let's get to it.
Let's do it.
Work is a doing.
Rookie era. You got to start the track at the beginning of the track. Let's go again.
Hello, Dr. Steve and Hugh. Big fan of the work you are doing. Question, I don't know if you have come across something like this before, kind of in and around the hierarchy of mental health. It's obviously fantastic that the recent surge in mental health related content has helped countless people, including myself. However, to me, there is an obvious hierarchy, with anxiety and depression receiving a lot more compassion and attention than tumultuous sides of bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, psychosis, or dissociative identity disorder. And obviously, anxiety and depression are the most common, so that would kind of justify it getting more attention. But I still think that certain mental health conditions are not really getting fair representation. And yeah, guys, I was wondering, how do we tackle that? Thank you.
Thank you. I mean, that's an Irish accent. Like, I think I have an Irish accent. That is just, that's like a Seamus Heaney poem in verbal form. That is just gorgeous.
It's brilliant. Absolutely. Yeah. But also a brilliant question, and really speaks to me. I love this idea, and I hope our listeners caught it, that there is a kind of a hierarchy of compassion that many people feel, and it's not intentional. It's not something that we sit down and think about, oh, I'm going to have more compassion for this person suffering than that person suffering. I think, you know, really that question embedded a key insight, which is maybe for many people, anxiety and depression, and maybe even for many people, substance use challenges, they're very relatable.
Yeah.
They you know, even if I haven't suffered from given, you know, issue, depression, there are loved ones there. I've seen it up close. We've all seen it up, just about everybody's seen it up close. And so here's the deal. I really believe that for many of us, our compassion is tied, I'm going to use a term that's right out of a textbook, tied to our empathic imagination, our ability to basically get ourselves inside the world of, through in our imagination, of this other individual. Like, can I, in my imagination, can I simulate, how about that? Can I simulate what this other person's going through, at least what I think they're going through? And we see somebody who's suffering maybe from panic disorder or severe depression or, you know, an addiction. And it was like, yeah, I think I can kind of get in that headspace. If we see somebody who's hallucinating, who's psychotic, who's lost touch with reality, who is completely disorganized, and, you know, maybe they're living on the street, maybe they're erratic, they're you know, volatile. And we're like, I don't even know what's happening here. I can't get inside that headspace. And it feels very other. It feels very.
And that's actually where my head went. Like, I was literally about to jump in and be like, you know, I think about like, oh, no. But like, those mental disorders
exactly.
are for like homeless people. Like, people like us don't have disorders like that. Like, they must have those disorders because they did something wrong. And even if you, that's not your opinion about homeless people, there is that just automatic weird bias that pops into your head and your brain just runs with it. It's like, oh, yeah. Hierarchy. Let's position myself in a really, really high, comfortable place in this hierarchy so I can look down at other people, because I don't know why, that's just the way we are.
It's the way we are. And, you know, so part of it is just that natural human tendency that we can feel empathy and compassion for people whose suffering feels like ours. We can identify with it. Secondly, if the person who's suffering feels like part of our tribe, part of our in-group, then it, again, part of human nature. I'm not happy about this, but it does seem to be part of our genetic legacy, our evolutionary legacy. We're a very tribal species, and that's served us well in our long sojourn as a hunter-gatherer species, where everybody's survival depended on the well-being of the tribe. You know, I had to get that in.
It's the cafeteria in Mean Girls, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
With like the voiceover about the animal kingdom, like
that's
just captures it so perfectly.
It really does. And so, you know, we still have this genetic legacy of this long sojourn in a world where everything hinged on the tribe. And so what did that mean? We have these off the shelf intuitions about who's in our group and who's outside. And if they're outside, by default, They are more suspect. We don't trust them to the same degree. We don't care about their well-being to the same degree. We don't have the same level of empathy. And one of the biggest tragedies historically regarding psychological suffering and mental illness is people who were mentally ill were regarded as not in the in-group, but rather the out-group. So you think about, you know, what would happen to somebody who was hearing voices, say, 400 years ago? Well, they in the West, they would often be called a witch.
A prophet. Or,
well, yeah, maybe if they're...
You're like, let's not even go there.
If they're very, very high status and, you know, but generally, no. I mean, generally, they would be regarded as demon possessed or, you know, it's like, oh, you're hearing voices. That's,
yeah, true. That's
you
more
know,
like it.
And so there wasn't that level of recognition that this is a fellow human being. This is, you know, we're all part of the same human family. We're all part of the same big in-group. And, you know, this, I just want to share, I think I've mentioned this to you before, but people ask me sometimes, they're like, okay, Steve, help me understand this. Like, dude, you were, as an undergrad, you never took a psych class. You went through a double major in math and economics. You wrote computer code. You worked for a major bank. You did commercial real estate. How the hell did you wind up at age 27 starting a PhD program in clinical psych? And I'm like, you know, a lot of it was when I was 25, I started volunteering at a psychiatric hospital as a community volunteer. Why? Because of my annoying friend, Dan. Actually, God bless him. He's one of my best friends in the world. And he said, you know, this would do you good. He's like, you're out there selling your soul in the corporate world, working for this big bank, doing all this soul crushing sort of work. Why don't you get down in the trenches with people who are really suffering, who just need human contact? So he's like, we have this right here. This was in Atlanta, Georgia at the time. It's like, we have this psych hospital in town where they have this back unit. It's like hermetically sealed off, locked unit with like the sickest of the sick patients. A lot of these patients, they're all psychotic. They've lost touch with reality. They're hearing voices. They have delusions. They're really, really sick and disabled, and they're desperate for volunteers to just come and be with them and spend time with them. And I'm like, challenge accepted. Like, it scared the crap out of me. But I was also intrigued. I was like, okay, well, I want to see it, you know? And so I get there and my first assignment is just hang out with these patients for 3 hours. If they want to play cards, if they want to talk, if they just hang out, give them some human contact, because most of them have never been visited by their families in the past year. They're just like in this warehouse where they're getting their meds and they're just kind of there, just vegging out. And it was life-changing for me because, I mean, I could see right away that they were suffering, that they were not in touch with reality some of the time. But the thing that jumped off, you know, just jumped out immediately was these are just fellow human beings. And in most respects, they're just like me. They care about what I think of them, just like I care about what they think of me. They really desperately want human connection. They care about basketball, some of them. So we shared our love of the NBA. They watch TV. They, you know, we like some of the same shows. It was so revelatory, because more than anything else, it just smacked me in the face with this epiphany that no matter how mentally ill somebody is, they're just a fellow human being. And yeah, they may be hearing voices and I'm not. And they may have really bizarro ideas and paranoid delusions and conspiracy theories and, you know, but like they're still in our family, you know? And so it shocked me at how much just a sense of compassion I started to grow for their condition. And then, of course, because of how I'm wired, it made me want to understand, you know, because I really believe knowledge is power. And so I just started studying. I started taking night classes in psychology. And I was like, I want to freaking do that for a living. So this is a topic that really is near and dear to my heart, even though, you know, some people who know of my work, they might be like, oh, you know, Steve, you're an expert in depression and in anxiety disorders. So you're really focusing on those common, you know, the sort of the things that are easy for people to get their minds around. But I've never lost touch with the deeper sort of issue that, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, this sounds so cliche. Some of my dearest friends in the world, two of my dearest friends in the world, including my co-host here, have bipolar disorder, which is, you know, was one that our listener had mentioned as like, oh, bipolar, really, really destabilizing disorder. You know, that's in that sort of scary other.
Yeah.
A lot of people.
Yeah.
Right. And I've treated so many people that are suicidal, and, you know, there's so much judgment around suicide where people are like, oh, I can't even, you know, like, I guess I could maybe imagine like you just get so desperate that you want to end yourself, but like, oh, that's so selfish. That's so, you know, it's like, no. It's like, when people are in that space, their suffering is so profound that they don't want to die. They want an escape. They want relief. They want, you know, and we need to have compassion, not judgment, you know?
Yeah.
And so all of these issues are right there front and center, no matter what part of the mental health space we're exploring, they always matter.
Well, I think it's really interesting because I'm going to do a classic, like, broad sweeping of the brush here, but
please,
you know, if you look back to like 100 years ago within your community, if there was someone who was like really depressed, they were kind of like the outlier. So in some ways, like, they were the homeless man on the street.
Oh, there
you know what I mean? They were like the, ooh, that's weird. Whereas now, because the depression rates and the anxiety rates are like so
sky high,
in some weird way, like, to have anxiety, have depression, makes you somewhat like neurotypical. Like, you're almost part of the in crowd. And so, because that in crowd has kind of like now involves like people with quote unquote normal mental health disorders, then I think by our nature, like, the things that are kind of outside of that, that seem scarier and, like you said at the start, less relatable, then we don't really have that drive or that compassion, or it maybe even there is fear around that. But all that to say, I think I want to call back to something you said in Addiction 101. And I was really pushing you on behavioral addictions because I'm a behavioral addiction guy. Yeah. Like, I'm like, you know, what about the porn addicts? What about the video game people? Like, what about social media, like teenagers that blah, 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 blah. And you were like, yes, all that's important. But like, there are more people taking their lives via drug overdose, accidental and intentional, than ever before. And so our most emergency break glass in case of emergency approaches should be to try to save as many lives as possible. And I think because schizophrenia and bipolar affect fewer people, in some ways we do collectively as a culture have to take a statistical approach and say, well, what is going to be for the greater good? And I don't want to open up a huge philosophical discussion.
It's
the reality of the numbers. Depression and anxiety are going to get more airtime because they affect more people, period.
Yeah, that's a really interesting, I like that insight. I you know, I do think on the other, I agree with all that, but on the other hand, schizophrenia is so disabling and it's only 1% of the population, but that's still 3 million Americans.
Wow.
You know, and what, 700,000 Britons. It's a lot of people. And for those individuals, it's often, usually, so disabling. And it has a high burden of suicidality as well, tragically. With bipolar, get this. When I was in graduate school 3 decades ago, we believed that the lifetime prevalence, you know, the how many people would get bipolar in their lifetime, was 1-2%. And now estimates are as high as 5%. That's not rare. That's, you know, 1 out of 20 people.
Wow.
And, you know, there are, we can have a whole episode on like why the increase. Is it real? I believe it is real. Why whole array of factors? I don't know if we want to talk about that right now, but you know, I'll give you a couple. I mean, obviously our life.
I knew you couldn't resist. I was like, all in right. my head, I already was like, you know, okay, bipolar 101. I see it all mapped out in my head and you're like, ah, I can't, okay.
Okay, never mind. Never mind. We'll talk. Yeah. Bipolar 101. Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to have a whole episode unpacking what is bipolar and why is it increasing? But, so yeah, I mean, when you look at the societal burden, even of less common disorders, it's gargantuan. I honestly think part of the issue right now is in the U.S., and I can't speak to what's happening in Britain, but in the U.S., 30, 40, 50 years ago, patients who were severely mentally ill with schizophrenia or severe uncontrollable bipolar disorder were often hospitalized for long periods of time and sometimes institutionalized for long periods of time, or they were put in like a halfway house or something where, you yeah. know, they had a lot of support, but they weren't really visible.
Yeah.
And then here in the States, over the last 40 years, we were like, oh, you know, that's so inhumane and cruel to have these folks in these hospitals. So let's get them out in the community and we'll like spend all this money and have all these great resources and all these social workers and we'll have all the, and everybody was like, oh yeah, okay, sure. That sounds good. And then they just kicked everybody out on the street and didn't follow up
yeah.
with the spending. And so it's like, what the hell did they think would happen
yeah.
if we kicked all these severely disabled patients out on the street without all the resources to help them actually make a go of it? Yeah, they're all living on the street. Not all of them, but you know, a huge share. So when you look at the problem of homelessness in the States, it is overwhelmingly people who are severely mentally ill, who a generation ago would have gotten a lot more care than they get now, and or people who are severely disabled by addiction. And that's the, I'm not saying that's all of it, but that's the vast majority of the chronically homeless. And yeah. so it's out there in people's faces and they're seeing it. And again, it feels very other in a way, you know, like a generation ago, you could say, well, you know, it was more invisible. Is that better?
But it was just out of sight, out of mind, really, wasn't it?
Yeah. Which I'm not sure is, you know, morally, ethically a better place. But I mean, at the very least, I think there was more of a sense of compassion
yeah.
for like, oh, that's too bad that, you know, that couple had the child who's in the institution and, oh, you know, that's a shame. And now that child is living on the streets and people are scared of that child.
Yeah.
And so they other, you know, it's like, oh, that's other, and they don't have any compassion.
So how do we go about kind of dismantling that hierarchy in some sense? Even like, I'm not asking you on like a societal level, but like, yeah. I think the question is very much
at an individual.
You could hear the empathy in the guy's voice.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, for us, if you know, if we are even in that in crowd, and maybe, you know, maybe we have like depression, maybe we have anxiety, like how do we
right.
try to organize and challenge some of the biases that we carry?
Yeah, so I'll tell you a quick story. So I had a student in my abnormal psych class about 22 years ago. He took it in the summer. Brilliant young man, bipolar disorder, and we stayed in touch. We used to play basketball together sometimes.
What were you like back then? Come on, tell me about it. Were you just destroying people? Were you just literally dominating the court?
No. very, very slow white dude with limited verticality, but pretty decent jump shot, decent handle, decent
okay.
court vision. So, you know, I could contribute. I was a role player.
So, dude, literally whenever I practice basketball in my back garden and I imagine us playing, like rocking up to a court in Belfast together, I picture you as the playmaker. You know what I mean? Like just like making it happen.
Yeah. So that's funny. Well, anyway, his name is Brian. He and I stayed in touch over the years and he is an amazing public speaker.
Oh, wow.
And he comes most semesters and gives a guest speaker talk about his experience with bipolar. And my students are blown away because they have this stereotype of like, oh my God, if somebody has bipolar, they're, you know, they're thinking like Kanye off the rails, you know, or other high profile people with bipolar who get psychotic or who get really, really, really disinhibited and, you know, all the stereotypes. And Brian comes and he's funny and he's charming and you can tell he's really suffered. He had a very, very severe suicide attempt as a young man, nearly died. And he still got a lot of the high spontaneity and creativity. Anyway, what always ends up happening is students flock to him and I have them share a reflection paper. And overwhelmingly, they're just like, I had no idea. Like, this puts a human face on bipolar and it shattered my stereotypes. And it gives me this sense of like, oh, like Brian is just a guy. He could be my friend. He could be my brother. He could be my uncle. He could be, you know.
Yeah.
And like, he seems so normal. Quirky, but normal.
Yeah.
And now you can see them going, bipolar, other outgroup, low compassion. Oh, bipolar. He's part of my people. He's like, and their compassion goes up and their understanding goes up. And you can see their circle of empathy grow. And you can see their circle of moral concern grow. And, you know, it's not that big a step to expanding it to schizophrenia. So I want to just drop one last little thing for our listeners, our viewers. There's an amazing TED talk by a woman who has been diagnosed with schizophrenia. And when she gives this talk, I believe as a clinician, she doesn't say this, but I believe she's at least in partial remission. She's doing well. She's still hearing voices. Her name is Eleanor Longden, L-O-N-G-D-E-N. You can look it up. We could put it in the show notes, Eleanor Longden. And I believe the TED Talk title, you can find it on YouTube, is like The Voices in My Head. And it's like 12 minutes. And you watch Eleanor, I promise you, your level of compassion and empathy for schizophrenia and people who hear voices is going to grow because you're going to be like, she could be me. Mm. She could be my sister. She could be my aunt. It's super cool.
Wow. We should actually talk about interviewing her. That would be really interesting.
Love it.
We come around to doing all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I just want to end, like, I just kind of want to tie back to something you said earlier. First of all, I love that point you just made. You said something like expanding your circle of empathy. I thought that was so great. Like, just visually in my mind, I was like, yeah, that works really well.
I wish that were mine.
Really? Is that a quote? Did you just professor me there?
Yeah, that's.
Hey, it's a Goodwill Hunter. It's like page 97, London.
Yeah, that's the philosopher Peter Singer.
Ah, nice.
We could put that in the show notes if you want. But Singer, he's probably the most important living moral philosopher. He's the catalyst behind the effective altruism movement. Will MacAskill, who's a Scottish philosopher, who's a young guy, not much older than you, I think, sort of took the ball and ran with it. But Singer talks about how we all have a circle of moral concern that starts with ourselves and our loved ones and maybe expands for most people out to their in-group, their tribe. And he says the greatest moral challenge of a human life is expanding that circle of moral concern to encompass the entirety of humanity.
Wow.
And then he's like, and when you get there, if you get like fully enlightened, then how about all sentient beings?
Yeah.
Because he wants you to be a vegan. I'm not there yet, by the way. That's a topic for another time.
Expand the circle, bro. You can do it.
I know. I need to get that tattooed on my wrist or something.
I love that. But you know, like you said earlier, like we all are part of the human family. And I think the more types of people we can bring inside that circle, the more we can kind of go forward and act like family, you know? So yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Literally, we're part of the same. So Have I shared this? I just got to share one little factoid. I know we probably should just stop right now, but I got to share one more thing. We can cut this if you want. Geneticists have fully sequenced the human genome for people all over the planet from different historically, geographically isolated groups, including Aboriginal groups in various parts of the world. And one of the questions they've asked is, if you plucked any two people off the planet and sequenced their genome and looked to see what's the most distantly they could be related? Or to flip the question on its head, how closely related are we? And they're like, you know what? At most, we're all 50th cousins. Like literally, we are all distant cousins of each. Like literally, you could pick any other person off the planet and at most, they are your 50th cousin. And that to me is so beautiful and so inspiring. And I literally think about it at least once a month.
Wow.
So, you know, we're all part of the same family.
I mean, there's no better way to end than that. So I'm really just going to end there. Thanks.
All right. Yay. Yeah. Likewise. This has been fun. I'd say it's a pretty good inaugural voyage.
I think so. You know, like this is us just two hobbits going off. Well, I'm the hobbit. You're the Gandalf, you know. I'm Frodo. You're the guy who shows up at the door, you know, can't fit into the house because you're so tall.
You know what? I am in touch with my inner hobbit. That's my story.
Let's not get into the hero's journey too much, but, you know, Gandalf was a hobbit one time. I mean, he wasn't actually a hobbit, but he was a young man and he went on a big journey. And
there you go.
That's his role now, is to be the mentor, you know, so.
Yeah. All right.
Peace out. Catch you next time.
Okay. Ciao.